give later. I know I'm already getting the emails from the Rebuilding Alliance, but is there a website to donate for Combatants for Peace?
Yeah, the Combatants for Peace and Rebuilding Alliance and Gush Shalom, all of their websites are on this flyer. So you can go directly to them. Actually, if you go to Gush Shalom, it comes back to the Resource Center because we've been supporting them for years, and we're accepting and forwarding donations for the Gush Shalom movement. As I said, in the last 6 weeks, we've sent about $40,000 to support Gush Shalom. So support any of these groups. I'm not trying to make a statement one or the other, except we have received so many calls about Gaza, I felt that we should put that in the picture. Yes. Okay. So the question is, she's visited Israel many times, and she's asking what's meant by the term occupation, because she's visited Shiloh and Ariel and other Israeli Jewish cities in the West Bank, and they look just like big cities that were built on bare rock. So it's a good question, and we'll let each of the speakers respond.
Well, what I mean by occupation is very clearly the territory is occupied by Israel in the 67 war. Now there are three things I should say. Well, first of all, this is not Israel. According even to Israeli law, this is not Israel. This is a occupied country where the sovereign is the Israeli army. According to the international laws, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, what is Israel is doing there, every settlement, every house, every plant there is a crime of war. And therefore, according to Israel's own obligations and affiliation to the international law, they must be dismantled. The second thing is that these are not just cities built on bare rock. There is a very, very clear political program behind it. Those cities were built on land reserves of the Palestinian villages and cities of the West Bank, with the clear idea of not permitting any kind of sustainable and coherent development of this land by Palestinians. These cities were planned and planted there as an obstacle for peace, as something that will promise that this land will never be divided. And as an obstacle for peace that had cost us so much, they must be dismantled. Now, a third thing, for most people who live there, these cities are just cities. They don't know and they are not aware of what I've just said. The government encourages people to go there. Buying a house there is 80% subsidized, by the way, by American money. Mm-hmm. With the guarantees and the aid you give us, our state has the money to do this kind of generous act. And these people are sent there to live and to be human shields for this expansionist project. And I think that we can't stand silent in front of war crimes. We can't stand silent in front of an expansionist ideology that wants to push peace as far as possible, and we can't stand silent in front of such an instrumental and cynic use of other people. And therefore, yes, all of these settlements must be dismantled.
Hassan, did you want to speak?
I'll repeat it. Go ahead.
Either one of you have experienced hostility from either side in your presentations or within maybe even your own family or among friends. Have you experienced
here or there? At home?
There.
Okay, the question is whether either or both of them have experienced hostility in their own families or their own communities at home when they've taken these positions. Let's start with Bassan.
Mm-hmm. Directly, no. We are safe. And we was not safe when we was fighting. Now we are safe. We are talking. This is my answer.
And this is also pretty much my answer. I don't want to destroy any romantic image here of persecuted dissidents, but quite frankly, no, we are not threatened and there aren't any sanctions against us. This is politics that developed, well, since the days of Courage to Refuse, when they realized, and this is exactly, goes directly back to what Donna said about the need that you will contact your representatives, that will contact the embassies here, that will apply pressure with questions, asking what happened. Because with this bully mentality, they know once you put a little bit of resistance, they fold. When we started with Courage to Refuse, the reaction was very, very severe. Every refusenik was sent to prison. I told you at a certain point there were over 200 reserve soldiers in prison. The discourse was extremely virulent, extremely violent. Traitors, cowards, fifth column, knife in the back, you should hang them. Certain labor ministers proposed 15 years imprisonment for people doing that, etc., etc. Very quickly they realized or they remember that it's not true. Israel is not really an army with a country. There's also a people living there. And we are civilians. We are not soldiers. We just go to the army 1 month a year. And we are lawyers and doctors and university professors, parliamentary aides, high-tech people, businessmen, a lot of sports journalists for some reason. But we have the capacity to yield a lot of power and make a lot of noise when we want to. And therefore, their attitude was to ignore us completely. And this way, the chief, the person responsible of human resources in the army can say, look, the conscientious objection movement is dead. There's no one in prison right now. They simply will not acknowledge us at all. This being said, I should mention the extreme violence in which joint demonstrations and joint activities are being repressed, where Israelis and Palestinians are subject to extreme, extreme violence. Many people were injured, many people ended in hospitals. Many injuries were critical. For the time being, thank God, nobody died. And we believe this is because, well, the army is more careful with the trigger when Israelis are in the crowd. But in these conditions, violence is really terrifying as well. Anyone can see if you look at the pictures coming from Bilin or a place like that. But in our political activity, they'll just ignore us completely.
Thank you. In the back. And then Marvin, second.
The question is whether in the initial meetings, if they had some kind of technique or method to help them to bridge the gap and begin to speak to each other, and whether in their ongoing communications, if they're also developing methods to communicate across these chasms.
In the first meeting, no. In the first meeting, we were simply terrified. And when people spoke and didn't pull out a gun or a knife, we were just very, very happy. And that was quite enough, and we thought this is a great method of moving on. Ever since, yes, we do think about it a lot. We do work about on this question a lot with professionals, with different people. We try many different things. I must say that for the time being, we haven't found any technique that was particularly more efficient than the other, than another, except really constantly meeting and constantly talking.
In 1948, the 49th State of Israel was created the founders of it were, to a great extent, people who believed in socialism. They believed in equality, they believed they built the kibbutzim, and they were turning the sand into a garden. And they had very great respect for the concept of people working together. Ben Gurion, as I understand it, one of the early prime ministers, long before he became prime minister, wanted to have a concept of the Arabs and the Jews, in one way or another, I don't remember which way, being together and working together. Do you look for anything like that ever coming up again, where that old spirit in the Israeli part of the country can be revived and improve the chances for...
The comment is that in the early days of the State of Israel, the founding of the state, that many of the leaders and many of the values expressed were socialistic and spoke about coexistence peacefully of the Palestinian and Jewish populations. And given how things have gone since then, the question is, do either of the speakers have a vision or a sense that in the coming years, any of that kind of hopeful coexistence can be recaptured or reattained? And I think it'd be good if they each spoke to it, not just the Israeli. Did you explain it to
It's pretty complicated trying to understand and to explain what happened really in Israel and how it all collapsed. My own interpretation that so many compromises were made in favor of national and nationalistic unity that at a certain point it was just it had no more meaning anymore. If we have these kind of visions, we have many kinds of dreams and many kind of visions, but I must say that this is a the work that we are doing is a very gray and tedious and ungrateful day-to-day activity. And yeah, it would be wonderful to see one great the United States of the Middle East, where everybody lives in solidarity and inequality, etc., etc. Right now, our dreams are much closer to the ground. We want to build this garden. We want to manage to put in place the five chapters that we've created now in different Palestinian cities, etc. We're step by step.
Hassan, do you want to speak to the future? And
I want to say to you just a few words. We will succeed. We will succeed because we want peace. We ask for peace. And we believe that we will succeed. But absolutely, we need you. We need your help. Don't let us alone. We want your help. Thank you.
I think it's there's no more appropriate ending than that.